This is Night Call, the first and only nationwide listener call-in show on vital issues. Tonight's subject is religion, big business. Tonight's guest, Alfred Balk, feature writer for the Saturday Review and author of a new book called The Religion Business. Night Call is your program. Share your opinions and ideas with the rest of the country. Speak for yourself and ask your questions directly by calling Night Call in New York City from anywhere in North America. Here are Night Call's special phone numbers. From the East and Midwest, call collect at area code 212-749-3311. From the West at 212-749-4300. And from the New York area at 866-5010. Now from New York City, Night Call's host, Del Shields.
Good evening. Tonight we're going to be talking about a most unique business, the religion business. To lead into the show, I can't think of a better way of stating the problem than the way Dr. Eugene Carson Blake, General Secretary of the World Council of Churches, put it. And he stated, and we quote, "When one remembers that churches pay no inheritance tax, churches do not die. That churches may own and operate business and be exempt from the 52% corporate income tax and real property used for church purposes, which in some states are most generally construed, is tax exempt. It is not unreasonable to prophesy that with reasonable, prudent management, the churches ought to be able to control the whole economy of the nation within the predictable future," unquote. It's very hard for me to conceive that religious organizations have an estimated value of $79.5 billion in estimated visible assets. Now, obviously, that's quite an industry we're talking about. And at that, one that's tax-free, which raises the obvious question, why don't churches pay taxes? How did this get started? And do the churches serve the needs of the people in a way that justifies a tax-free status? Now, tonight, my guest calling in from New York City is Alfred Balk, who was previous editor of Saturday Review and the author of a book, The Religion Business. Mr. Balk, good evening, sir.
Good evening, Del.
And thank you for being with us.
It's my pleasure.
Before we get started about whether or not churches should pay taxes, could you describe for us what the visible assets are that are represented by this $79.5 billion of the church?
Yes. Actually, when we talk about religious property, most people think of church buildings, the house of worship, and so on. But, of course, it includes much more. When you look into it, it includes, of course, the house of worship, perhaps the place of residence of the priest or minister, Sunday school wings, and so on, even into youth camps and that kind of thing. Hospitals, in some cases parochial schools. That's what we mean by visible assets. And these are not listed and reported by churches and can only be estimated. This is one estimate, $79.5 billion. Others, reputable ones, range from $40 billion to $100 billion. Then there's perhaps $2 billion or more in denominational pension funds, all kinds of stock investments, various kinds of businesses from television stations and hotels, and mushroom burger restaurant chains and wineries to the Real Form Girdle Company, which is owned by a church in Ohio.
Well, should churches own business at all? Is this in keeping with the spiritual concept of churches?
Well, this, of course, is a burning question which troubled Eugene Carson Blake when he made that statement, because that is in a competitive profit-making economy like ours, a question, of course, for people who believe in free enterprise. This is a tax-free competition for paying business. It's also a philosophical and theological question. There seems to be great sentiment now among many thinkers, and a poll by a CBS television show on the subject of the business of religion, and in some sectors of Congress, to say, while the churches perhaps should remain tax-exempt on their house of worship, that kind of property, there's no real sentiment against that now. Certainly they shouldn't be allowed through this loophole, which is a federal loophole, to operate businesses tax-free. If churches do want to operate businesses, let them pay like others who operate businesses. But don't make the public subsidize it and encourage all kinds of rather subtly shady deals, which are increasing as this loophole advantage of by sharp businessmen.
When we talk about the loophole, is it possible to point the guilt to anyone? Is it the guilt of the legislators who refuse to amend this law or to plug the law, or is it the guilt of the church authorities who take advantage of it, or is it the guilt of the laymen who allow this to be done?
Well, in my book, I don't so much talk about guilt as... And it's certainly not an anti-religious book. On the contrary, I hope, examines through statements of religious leaders serious concerns here. It's not so much guilt as perhaps oversight, as perhaps things that just happened, at least earlier, and now perhaps a sort of lack of courage. Many laymen don't realize how deeply the churches are involved and how rich they really are. As organizations now, certainly individual church parishes in some cases are poor. We will perhaps get calls tonight from people who are members of very poor parishes with struggling ministers and so on. But as a group, there is so much wealth here that we need to realize it first, and then not necessarily guilt, but I think conscience and initiative and courage, including that of public officials, to help rectify this, if this is indeed wrong.
Where the religious organizations are involved in business, is there any evidence of the influence of the church being involved in this business?
I think I understand. Correct me if I don't understand your question. Yes, some churches, some parishes, and this is... Of all persuasions, from the so-called fundamentalist to modernist, and from large to small, some actively seek businesses. Now, the Real Form Girdle Company and businesses like that, I'm sure if you investigated, you would find they didn't just happen. A well-known radio pastor named Carl McIntyre is reported to be amassing properties on behalf of his sect or group, religious group in New Jersey. Sometimes these are actively sought. In other cases, as has been testified before Congress, businessmen seek out religious groups or church groups and work what's called a sale and lease back so that they still keep their business and work on a salary in terms of management. And over a period, the business pays for itself, the church owns it, and the only losers are the taxpayers. So,
would you explain in a little more detail the sale and lease back arrangement?
Yes, it's also known as a bootstrap purchase, and this was lamented by an assistant U.S. Secretary of the Treasury before Congress, because this has gotten to Congress. This this Treasury official, Mr. Stanley Suri, read from advertisements of organizations seeking businesses, explaining how you can double your income without putting a penny down. And what happens, really, is that there is a sale on paper of a property. No money changes hands, because of course the people who want to sell the property to the nonprofit, the tax-free organization, don't need to take the money if they still keep their jobs and high incomes. Then there is a lease back. The church or religious group which buys the business on paper just leases it back to the same people. It runs like it was before, except it doesn't pay taxes. So no money changes hands. The Wall Street Journal points out the business buys itself in about 20 years. But there's a question of ethics here, of course, and all of us taxpayers make up for the lost taxes and so on.
Does this place an unfair advantage to competitors where religious organizations might be competing against other people for a particular business?
Well, indeed it does, and this, of course, is a concern of a number of businessmen. I mentioned in my book, The Religion Business, how in one case in Dayton, Ohio, a businessman complained that he had been underbid by a religious affiliated group on a government contract because they were tax exempt and he wasn't. And that's an irony, because this was a government contract. So we weren't saving anything by getting the low bid in that case. In another case, in New Orleans, for example, one of the main network TV stations and radio stations there is owned by a religious order, and its competitors have a terrible time competing, their executives have told me, because the other station, in effect, has bonuses on all its money. And so it does interfere with competition, of course, because you can imagine, if you're a businessman, what an advantage not to have to pay the same taxes your competitors do.
Mr. Bork, do you feel that the lay members of the churches are concerned about the ethics of this practice?
Yes, some lay members have definitely expressed this interest and concern. It's evidenced in talks before congregational meetings. It's evidenced in communications to legislators. It's evidenced in letters to authors like me and to publishers. There's a lot of discussion now on the part of lay people as well as others about this. And I think there's real concern about what kind of morality is it for the church to be, in effect, if not compromised, riding two horses here in talking about the morality of a business society and then allowing this kind of thing to go on under the guise or under the umbrella of religious organizations, even if your church itself and your denomination isn't so active in it. So there's a good bit of conscience examining, but before anything can change, it must grow. People have to think and learn much more about this, and that's why I wrote the book, because a church press asked me to, John Knox Press, which is a religious press, after I wrote an article. They think people need to know more and think more and then act.
Well, since you've written the book, The Religion Business, do you think that you will get any kind of violent reaction from churches?
Well, I would be saddened and somewhat surprised, because it's not a violent book. As I say, it's not intended to be anti-religious. I'm a professional journalist, a reporter, and editor, and we try to present the situation fairly and not be alarmist on the one hand or go to the other extreme. We, in fact, devote part of the book to policy statements by various denominational groups, and these include the National Council of Churches Study Group, the Methodist, the Presbyterians, American Lutherans, an Episcopal group, and a Baptist Joint Committee group. So, on the contrary, from the response I've had in being on some broadcasts and so on, I think that people really feel there is a matter of concern here. I think many church members are concerned. What's it all about if we're building buildings and if this kind of thing is going on? And they want religion to be more vital, and they see that this is a problem.
If churches were to be taxed, do you think they would continue their work in the area of social work?
I think there's a lot of misapprehension on the part of many people as to how this wealth is used. I think the amount that goes into social work can easily, and social causes, and helping the poor and feeding the hungry, operating schools and hospitals, can easily be overestimated. And in fact, there are estimates here that, for example, the National Council of Churches was told at a convention by a speaker that 41 cents a month per member of our churches is what is spent on services to those outside of churches. And in Chicago, in a recent year, $75 million was received by Protestant churches, and only $6 million was spent outside the congregations. So the question is, how much of this is being spent for these causes now, you see?
This is Night Call in New York, and our conversation tonight is Religion Big Business, and our guest is Mr. Alfred Bork, a feature writer for the Saturday Review and author of a new book called The Religion Business. We'll return to our guest, Mr. Bork, following station identification. Stay tuned for the Night Call Network.
More Night Call with Del Shields and guest Alfred Bork after station identification.
School and you're between 16 and 22, Job Corps wants to give you a chance to start again. A chance to learn the skills that can help you get a good job. Maybe as a typist, a practical nurse, a receptionist. Just about anything. And while you're learning, you'll be living at a Job Corps center. You'll get free medical and dental care, clean clothes, your own bed to sleep in, and 3 square meals a day. Job Corps will even pay you while you're learning. See your state employment office or write Job Corps, Washington, D.C. Job Corps will give you a chance. Just for once, give yourself a chance.
Ask your own questions direct. Speak for yourself collect from anywhere in North America to guest, writer, and social critic Alfred Bok about the big business aspects of religion in America. All Night Call Collect from the East and Midwest on area code 212-749-3311. From the West on area code 212-749-4300. And from the New York area on 866-5010. Again, Dell Shields.
And we'll take our first call of the evening from New Orleans. Mr. McCann is hearing Night Call over WDSU. Mr. McCann?
Hello, Mr. Falk.
Yes.
I'm very interested in your subject. I just wondered if you had thought of what would happen if anything is done to break up, call it what you want, a racket or whatever you want. But if you start taxing the churches, you've got a bigger one, just as big a one, to jump right on the heels of it, and it'll go with like lightning. And that's the universities and schools, you know, that have that are subsidized, that have got huge sums.
Yes.
Take Yale, Harvard. Take Harvard, for instance. The millions they've got in the property that's non-taxed.
Well, as a matter of fact, First, let me say, I agree with you that there are problems with other tax-exempt organizations. And matter of fact, I am now engaged in a study of all tax exemption problems at the Russell Sage Foundation, a reputable foundation which feels that a look needs to be taken at all these things, including foundations, universities. But it's important to understand that universities do not have the same tax loophole anymore that religious organizations do. In 1950, there was a tax law revision at the federal level, and universities and various societies which used to have that same exemption could operate businesses tax-free, lost it, and many of the university spokesmen agreed this was wrong, but somehow the churches and religious organizations, as I mentioned in the book, came out having this loophole, and that, of course, has tended to put more pressure on and siphon more businesses into the religious sector for tax escape purposes.
My face is red now.
Well, there's a lot I didn't know.
There was a lot of noise right here in New Orleans about. You see, that station you mentioned happened to be owned by the Jesuit Order.
That's right.
And CBS tried to buy it. So.
Yes, well...
Now that organization also owns a school, a university here.
That's right. Now again, here's a technicality. If a university is operated by a religious order, as it is in that case in New Orleans, then the bets are off again and it's exempt. Because you see, anything a religious organization operates has this special advantage, even if it's not, as I say, primarily for religious purposes. So there are lots of things I found out in reporting on this that others will find, too.
Yeah, well, being a lawyer, it kind of embarrassed me, that's all.
Well, you have a good point there.
A whole lot. I enjoyed listening to you.
Thank you.
Thank you for calling, sir.
Thank you.
Mr. Bork, is the question whether or not the churches should be taxed, or is it the need for a redefinition of the tax structure concerning churches?
Well, there are several questions, really. As I say, I do not advocate in the book, nor is there any great sentiment for taxing churches on houses of worship, on parsonages, let us say, for that kind of thing. There is definitely divided opinion and growing sentiment for closing what appears to have been just a loophole that growed in these ancillary areas. There is need, of course, for continually for looking at our tax structure. Tax exemptions have really grown, and as the gentleman in New Orleans suggested, because of other institutions as well as religious properties. For example, 3 decades ago, 12% of our real property in this country, it's estimated, was exempt. Now it's about 30%, it's estimated. In New York City, a third of the property valuation is off the tax rolls. Well, you see, how can you run a city? Other cities have comparable problems. How can you run it when all the taxpayers must make up for all this exempt property? So we got a big complicated problem here.
Well, if the church is so wealthy, why is it they don't pay the clergy more? For instance, I have a friend who was a clergyman. After 7 years of school, he'd be starting at about $4,200 a year.
Well, that's a very significant question, because now that there are strains showing in the churches, which leads laymen and ministers to feel that maybe there is something wrong with the system and it needs adjustment. The clergy are, as I have said, poor as church mice in some cases. Again, it goes back to how wealthy are the religious organizations, and what do they use their wealth for? And you see, when you examine that, it turns out that much of the wealth seems to be spent on things, buildings, $1 billion a year on church construction. We now have one church, for example, for every 600 Americans, and yet there are 70,000 parishes that don't have regular pastors. Well, something's wrong with the system and the way the money's being used, perhaps, and clergymen's salaries are one example.
We'll take our next call from Brooklyn, New York. Mr. Walters is hearing Night Call over WLIB-FM. Mr. Walters?
Yes, you almost answered my question. Now, I wanted to know where the surplus money goes. Are there managing agents for these businesses? And who gets all the bulk of the money? You gave an example where one place, one sector made $75 million, and only $3 million was used for social purposes outside the church. Where does all this money go?
Well, this again is a complicated question, and I don't want to indicate, and did not indicate in the book, that there's a conspiracy, that this is that there are dark shadows here. That I think that one, we have to realize religion got big like a lot of other things got big. With bigness comes layers of bureaucracy and levels of authority. As our population has moved, church building has gone on, and we have large denominational pension funds, which represent endowed funds, in effect, that in some cases just lie there. Some people have said they should be used for social purposes like poverty programs and investments in integrated housing and so on, where they'd still earn interest.
Right.
There's a lot there. We really don't know. This is a problem, and we really don't know. Some Catholic priests have complained in several parishes. Some Protestants have. We really don't know, in some cases, how headquarters are allocating their money.
This is like the Black Ages. It's like a dark secret that $50 million a year just is hidden someplace and no one knows where it is.
Well, it's not that no one knows, it's that the public doesn't know, and sometimes the church members don't know. And this is one issue in the church reform movement, you see, that there be more openness about where the money is and how it's used. And it is changing. It is changing, although the churches still are not required, as are other tax-exempt groups, to make the kind of financial reports which would put this above board.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you for calling, sir.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Bork, if the profits from these various transactions of the religious orders was being directed into the area of human relations and more in social work, would there be a need for a change in the tax structure? Would we object to the sale and leasebacks and the other transactions that go on?
Well, let us say this. We could object because a neutral observer, to the extent there is such a thing, who's trying to make a systematic to sort out things in our economy so that things are as they seem, so that we know what we're subsidizing with tax exemptions, and so that it's the kind of things that all of us, the majority of us, society, feel ought to be subsidized, because after all, we all make up the difference on these exemptions. The churches right now could do much more under existing laws than they are. I wrote an article, for example, about a man who tries to encourage integration through building and buying integrated housing. First place he went when he wanted to start this was to some denominational pension funds in Philadelphia. And he got turned away cold, and he was floored. He was shocked because these were FHA guaranteed. There was no risk at all, and it was on a business basis. But again, you see, churches and church organizations have to think more and are beginning to think more about how the money's used, because money is power, and power is never neutral. And you're using it for something. You're either using it for social purposes or for more materialism. Now, churches are being encouraged by the present tax structure to go into housing for the elderly, for example, nursing homes in some cases. If Congress and other public officials, after hearing the voice of the people feel this is legitimate, then who could object? But the point is, we have to be sure we've considered all these decisions, and this is what we want to do on a tax-free basis.
Well, it seems that on the basis of the amount of money that we've quoted tonight in terms of visible assets, that much more could be done by the churches if this money was directed in the areas where it is needed, that we would not have to consistently fall back on the government or the federal government for help. Am I right in that?
Yes, this is true, and this is another issue that concerned the churchmen raised. You know, they say, in a country this large, with the variety of population we have and all of our problems of growth and so on, somebody's got to take care of needs, some group. If the private sector and the churches who say they exist partly for that reason won't do it, it's going to be government every time, because we can't allow these things, these needs, to go unmet. So this is definitely true, and this is an issue. And this is what a lot of meetings in local parishes are warming up about. It's the question of what are we doing with our money, with our organization? Why do we exist? Are we really doing what the founder of our religion said we should do about the poor and about morality in society? Aren't we using our power for to negate what we say we believe in if we don't change and quit building so many buildings and having this kind of thing go on? Obviously, you can't have a church in a tent, but there's a medium here.
We'll take our next call from Great Neck, Long Island. Mr. White is hearing Night Call over WLIB-FM. Mr. White?
Hello.
Good evening, sir.
How are you?
Fine, thank you.
It was a question raised by something that you said about it not being a dark plot or anything like that. And while I don't believe it is a plot, I think in terms of New York City, it's an immensely serious kind of thing that's reached a point of no return. I'm a printer and have worked in downtown New York for many years, and most of the buildings I've worked in have been owned by Trinity Church. And just an enormous number of buildings down there are owned by the church and leased to management agencies.
That's correct.
I don't know what the percentages might be of the entire church set up in New York, but certainly Trinity has such an enormous percentage that I would feel, in light of the needs of the city at present, that merely removing the exemption from Trinity might go a long way towards funding so many vitally needed things, which the city at present states it cannot do. And that's the point of my my question. If the city cannot financially meet these obligations, it almost is incumbent, I think, upon the city to alter this tax picture.
Well, you have a good point, and as a matter of fact, if the city had the power, you understand, city governments are handmaidens to an extent. If state law and federal law permitted some of these things, cities might do it. As a matter of fact, Mayor Lindsay's administration is looking into the exemption situation now and is going to ask the legislature, there's been stories about this, to modify the exemption picture, because there are inequities here, and all of us are suffering for it. And Trinity Church is very old, more than 150, 200 years old. This, again, is a situation that grew up from when that was farmland down there. Now it's valuable property. Mm-hmm. So these things are being examined here for that very reason, and in other cities, too.
I see.
And I would assume also that we could add that there are certain churchmen who are interested in looking at this problem, and one of the cases being right here at Night Call, where we are a church-sponsored program by the United Methodist Church and in cooperation with the Council of Churches and other organizations, so there are people who are concerned about it.
Yes, I think it's significant that we're talking about a book published by a church publisher, John Knox Press, on a program sponsored by a church organization here.
Well, that's good news.
Thank you for calling, sir. Thank you very much for calling.
Bye-bye.
This is Night Call in New York, and Is Religion Big Business is our discussion tonight, and it would seem to me that there are many lay members of churches who might be interested in the problem of is religion big business, and I think that if one was to ask the question, this does not necessarily make you anti-church, so we welcome your calls. We'll return to our guest, Mr. Alfred Bork, following station identification. Stay tuned for the Night Call Network.
More Night Call with Del Shields and guest Alfred Bork after station identification. Next week on Night Call, the problems of growing old and the tragedy of nursing homes in America. The growth and changes in the Black Liberation Movement, not only in America but around the world. An internationally known columnist on what's happening in Washington. A trial lawyer for dissenters, Rap Brown, Southern Christian Leadership Conference, and Yippie Jerry Rubin. And the problems of the poor in America's most depressed and isolated area, Appalachia. Monday, Richard Garvin, critic of America's treatment of old people, who says the filth of old people's homes is worse than any slum. Tuesday, James Forman, chairman of the International Affairs Committee of SNCC. Wednesday, Drew Pearson, Washington columnist on what's happening on Capitol Hill. Thursday, trial lawyer William Kunstler, attorney for the dissent. And Friday, Harry Cowdell, author of Night Comes to the Cumberlands on the squalor, ignorance, and poverty of Appalachia. All this next week on Night Call. Ask your own questions direct. Speak for yourself collect from anywhere in North America to guest, writer, and social critic Alfred Balk about the big business aspects of religion in America. Call Night Call Collect from the East and Midwest on area code 212-749-3311. From the West on area code 212-749-4300. And from the New York area on 866-5010. Again, Del Shields.
And we'll take our next call from Mrs. Carville, who is hearing Night Call in Albany, New York, from WGY in Schenectady. Mrs. Carville?
Yes, Mr. Shields.
How are you feeling?
Well, I'm fine.
Thank you for calling. Your question,
Thank
ma'am.
Thank you. It's a fine topic you have tonight. And I was wondering, Mr. Valk,
yes.
Is it possible to get more of this topic and more detail in local newspapers and things? Because I think it's... And I don't consider myself anti-religion at all, but I think it's something that today, I think if people knew more about the errors in our society, that it's a fine thing to discuss them with an open-minded fashion.
Well, I think that as a journalist, I would agree that we should discuss. All of us who are reporters and writers and editors feel that... That our job is to inform people so you can make decisions. And I'm sure that there are ways in which your newspapers in your town could deal with this, including, if they like, they could excerpt from my book or any other writings on the subject. There have been writings in some religion magazines about this. There could be a panel of various ministers on some of your broadcast stations. I think if you would talk to your editor and explain that you're interested in this, and probably others are, that this might suggest to him something that he'd be interested in.
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't think, I think a lot of people today feel that if you do question something that you're antagonistic, and I don't feel that way at all. I think if we know the truth of something, complete truth is the answer to everything.
Well, this is true, and of course our founding fathers of this country would absolutely agree, because they wrote that First Amendment about freedom of speech to assure, protect freedom of speech and the press and religion and discussion.
Yeah,
so exactly, so that we could all ask questions, and I hope the time never comes when it becomes anti or subversive to ask constructive questions and to, in good faith, try to get information out to people. That's what democracy is about. We discuss and question and ask, and then we all make our decision.
Well, I think probably lots of times, and to me it's even in keeping with religion, to feel that you should be able to question and just to seek truth, that's all. I mean, that's just common, maybe the golden rule or just common sense. But as far as this, I have heard about the book, and I wish I don't... sorry, I don't get more time to read. I'm going to try and get the book and read it. As far as having the property tax exempt, I don't know. I think this tax exempt property is posing a problem in many areas, not only with churches, but other things, as you mentioned before.
Yes.
I did wonder, and I did write a letter not long ago on property taxation, which I almost think that's outdated too, because I think that started back when America was young, and individuals own their own homes, which isn't necessarily true anymore, probably. I'd love to know the estimate on how many people own their homes versus those who don't. course, this isn't church property, but that's property taxation, you know?
Well, there's been a lot of criticism of the property tax system, and there are a lot of things wrong with it.
Well, I think it's wrong.
Including exemptions, but it raises a lot of money, and until we can find another source, it'll probably be with us, so maybe we should try to adjust it and live with it.
I think your income tax idea, on as far as individuals go, is a lot more democratic than property taxation.
Well, that's one that economists kick around, and of course the trend seems to be more toward the income tax idea on organizations or individuals, because then it's honest. You know where the money's coming from, and those who rent as well as those who own are paying, and so on.
Well, I think owning property...
But that's another whole nights or whole weeks or years
subject. I'd like that as a topic, too, but I think that's based on your values in life, whether you do or don't own property, more than anything.
Well, this may be true, but I think the first thing you said about the importance of being able to question without having your motives impugned is important, whether it's in a religious organization or not. And if you will look at the history of the founder of the Christian religion, he, after all, did question the religion of his time, and there was a materialism question then, and that this is a tradition through I think the enlightened aspects of Christianity and other religions too.
Well, I myself would feel that as far as if they're involved in a very lucrative business, I would feel that they should be taxed. That would be my own feeling.
Well, then what you should do is let your legislators know, both in Washington and in your state capital, and also let your denomination know, because we must have some sympathy for the public official's position, which is that on a controversial question, and this is a touchy one, he has to be sure he's acting in a way that'll have support.
Well, don't you think that if the people know the whole truth, that then they'll write a more honest answer to these people?
Well, yes, I as a journalist, I have to say yes, and of course that's one reason I wrote the book. It's not, I don't claim it's the whole truth, but it's a discussion starter and gives you some basic information, and then you can go on from there. Truth is a very elusive quantity, and we want to be careful we don't assume it. You can get it overnight, but...
Are we not also assuming that all people want truth?
Yes, there are...
So, really, Mr. Shields, don't you, really?
No, I don't.
Don't you?
No, I do not.
You don't think they want it, you mean?
I think that most people are afraid of truth.
Oh, I think it's the most wonderful thing in the world. I don't think there's anything quite as scary as having a wrong opinion. I mean, to me, I like to argue with people, and I don't mean in a nasty way, but I mean to get the other fellow's side of it.
Well, I'm not disputing that truth is wonderful. I just feel that most people are afraid of truth.
They're afraid of it. Well, it's too bad, because that's the answer to everything, I think, truth.
Well, it sometimes truth is unpleasant and painful, or truth hurts, as some people
say.
Yeah,
but we try to cover it up, and you'll get into more pain than you would if you knew the truth, I think.
Well, I think you can take an example of the subject that we're discussing tonight, is religion big business. If a legislator honestly feels within himself that there should be some change, and as Mr. Bork stated, that the legislator stands there kind of in fear that his attempts to make change might result in his being voted out of his position. And then you have the lay people in the church who are afraid to question the authorities of the church, even though within themselves they might feel that the truth should come out, but they are afraid to.
That's a sad thing, when people have to be afraid of truth. I know it's true. I know what you're saying is true, but to me, the individual is important, always. And that he should know whatever it is he's capable of knowing to the utmost. This is terribly important, I think.
Well, I think the thing that many people forget is that if you do believe in truth, and sincerely do and want to make it prevail, you have to work. It doesn't just happen. There are all kinds of interpretations of what is truth, and there are people, as Mr. Shields suggests, who aren't interested in it. They're selfish or whatever, or misguided.
Well,
and here, certainly, this is true. If people feel that there need to be some changes without being anti-religion, but just to make some adjustments, it won't just happen. You have to work.
No, I think religion, I mean, now to go into the trip to the moon recently, I think the most wonderful thing was the quote from the Bible. It was wonderful to know that we could have such great advances in science and still have a religious mind with it. I think this was tremendous. This is a personal opinion. But there again, I don't think you have to separate. You know, you've got to keep your truth and your religion and all these things, and they sort of go together to me.
Well, maybe we could sum it up by saying that if you do sincerely seek the truth and study and investigate and come to a conclusion and want to see it prevail, then you should get busy and work and bring it about. And maybe we could close on that note.
Well, thank you ever so much, and I appreciate this program.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And thank you for calling.
Thank you.
Mr. Bork, I don't know if I am willing to to see the laws change to have churches exempt from being taxed. I think I'm interested, though, in that bulk of money that is lying somewhere that possibly could be used for the good of not only the people of that particular organization, but for the good of all people. It seems that there's a vast amount of money that's lying around that could help to ease a lot of poverty and could help a great deal of people.
Well, yes, this is true, but it's not just money lying around in money form necessarily. Some of it is going into things, buildings, air-conditioned pews. There's a controversy over a giant new cathedral in San Francisco, for example, which critics have called a golden calf. So, you see, many times things seem worthwhile, and we think that it's very easy for a congregation to say, we're a congregation, we should have a bigger and bigger and better building, but there is a point beyond which maybe it's frills, maybe it becomes almost unchristian or a golden calf, because there are other needs. And in fact, it's interesting, the Cathedral of St. John the Divine in New York City is still unfinished, and the pastor says will remain unfinished. It's a giant building. Will take several million to complete. He says it will remain unfinished. They will have no more fund drives as long as there are the pressing human needs in the cities. Bishop Sheen has spoken out on this in his parish upstate in New York. So it's partly, you see, re-emphasis and re-examining how we use our resources and whether we really do need to what seems to be the American way of building bigger and bigger. Maybe it's a trap sometimes.
Well, I would also be concerned about what effect the church ownership has on a particular business. I would be concerned about whether they were practicing fair employment or equal opportunity. I would be concerned about the conditions of the workers. I would also be concerned about whether or not they might be undue influence in these areas, and also whether or not the church takes the responsibility if a business is not really living up to the letter of the law, or something happens that might reflect badly on the church. Is the ownership of this hidden? Or does it come out? You know, are you willing to take the full responsibility of it? I think there's so many areas we can go into.
Well, that's right. And a lot of times this is ducked. But again, there is a project, you know, by the National Council, isn't it? The Interracial Council, a Catholic group for justice, interracial justice.
Yes.
In which churches and religious groups are urged to and assisted in finding out which organizations discriminate and which do not. And they feel certainly people who claim a religious affiliation should not abet organizations which are going against their ideals, the religious group professes.
Mr. Bork, we're going to break for station identification, and then we'll be coming right back.
Fine.
This is Night Call in New York.
More Night Call with Del Shields and guest Alfred Bork after station identification. Monday night on Night Call, the tragedy of aging in America. What do we do with our old people? What do they need and what do they deserve? And can we call old people they when tomorrow we will be they? Now, one out of every 10 Americans is over 65, and next year there will be 19 million people in that age group. Many of these will make up half the patients in our mental hospitals. Most of the others will be sent to nursing homes, which do not employ registered nurses. Today, 2 out of 5 skilled nursing beds are in homes that do not meet minimum health and safety standards. Most are profit-making businesses, but in many cases, the profit is made by starving the patients. These facts about nursing homes were uncovered by Richard Garvin, author of a new book called Where They Go to Die. Garvin says the filth and human degradation of some old people's homes are worse than any slum. Richard Garvin, Monday night on Night Call. Ask your own questions direct. Speak for yourself, collect from anywhere in North America to guest, writer and social critic Alfred Bok about the big business aspects of religion in America. Call Night Call Collect from the East and Midwest on area code 212-749-3311. From the West on area code 212-749-4300. And from the New York area on 866-5010. Again, Del Shields.
And this time out to Columbus, Ohio, Mr. Miller is hearing Night Call over WOSU-FM. Mr. Miller?
Yes, sir.
Good evening,
Mr.
sir.
Malk,
yes.
You're saying that the churches are spending a good deal of money on buildings and not for social purposes. I think it should be borne in mind that historically, Christian religions have felt that a church building itself should glorify the Lord and therefore should be a magnificent and imposing structure. And the high cost of church buildings is justified on the basis that this is a devotion, a method of showing devotion to the Lord.
Well, yes, this is a true expression of a viewpoint I know that exists. However, I would say we need to remember two things in that connection. One is that historically, when the church has been wealthiest and had the biggest buildings, it's been weakest, and in fact has sometimes gotten so wealthy its properties have had to be taken over by the state. This happened, as you know, about the time of the Reformation. It's happened in several countries in Europe. It's happened in Mexico. So that this is what Eugene Carson Blake was talking about. And then secondly, I think there's a matter of keeping it in context as to what is a suitable building for built to express the devotion. And this is what the pastor at the Cathedral of St. John the Divine was raising when he said, when there are such pressing needs, when most of the world is hungry and ill and ignorant and starving, how can a Christian in good conscience, how can a Christian go and ask others to build a bigger and bigger church when all these things are going on? So it's everything's related to everything else, and perhaps a few national cathedrals might be in order, a few headquarters-type cathedrals.
Yes.
But there's a question as to whether in the suburbs, for example, you need a multi-million dollar plant and all the comforts when all these other things prevail. That's really the question.
Well, I concur with your point of view, and I realize that this what's happened at the Church of St. John the Divine does represent a change in the thinking in this respect. I have one other comment, and that relates again to your expression that the church is not spending a great deal of money on social needs, and that is that there is, and I think historically true too, that the many Christian religions have felt that their mission is primarily spiritual rather than social, that their money should be spent for the saving of souls and for evangelical and missionary purposes and not for social purposes.
Yes, well, here I think we need to be sure we understand what we mean by social purposes and by spiritual. And then you have to consider, I think, can you really say you're being spiritual and spending money for spiritual purposes if you are ignoring, let us say, the poor, the sick, who come to your door, who are all around you? Can you be a spiritual person and ignore this and go out and say, stay there, I want to stay in my comfortable home and go to my comfortable church, you see, and save souls? Is there a contradiction in that kind of attitude? Again, it's a matter of relationships.
There's no easy answer. I concur with your point of view on this, too. However, I just want to justify the position of the church in these matters where they're saying, well, we should build a good, a fine edifice to glorify the Lord, and our money should go for spiritual rather than social purposes. And I say this, apparently some people have felt, although you denied it, that there might be a conspiracy involved here or something going on under the table where... And that's the reason why this money isn't being spent for social purposes. And I think not the case. The church has other demands on the money, which they feel justifies not spending the money for social purposes.
Well, I think you stated that very well. First of all, it's just it's not a conspiracy, of course. This isn't all the millions of churchgoers aren't a monolith. If there are errors, they are, let us assume, errors in good faith. But
yes.
Errors in good faith can be just as harmful.
Yes. Yes.
And cry out just as much for correction. And of course, on the matter of being concerned about a meeting place, a place of worship, and so on, that's legitimate, of course. And each congregation has to decide for itself.
Yes.
And we have religious freedom here, and that's why we have this great variety of and the government does not interfere. Separation of church and state prevails. A congregation can, if it wants, do all these things. You have to question, is that what I want for my religion? Is that what I should encourage in our society by the way I influence my legislator to draw the laws and so on?
Mr. Miller, thank you so much for your comments.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Goodbye.
We'll take our next call from Elkhart Lake, Wisconsin. Reverend Romer is hearing Night Call over WTMJ. Reverend Romer?
Hello.
Good evening, sir.
This is Reverend Raymer speaking.
Oh, Raymer, I'm sorry, sir. How are you feeling?
I've been listening to the conversation to your program this evening, and there's my little part that I would like to inject at this time.
Yes.
First of all, I would raise the question, are all organizations in USA taxed? That would mean any organization, regardless of religion. Is the church an organization? And are they organizations, then, who are taxed and who are paying their taxes? Do not all church people pay their taxes? Or could anyone accuse them of being tax evaders?
Well, Reverend, you've raised...
that the church people, after they pay their taxes, have a right to do with the leftover money as they desire. This is my first point. And my second point would be, I believe the religious institutions of USA have done the greatest amount of good ever done in the American continent. And they've been the leaders in any good that has ever been accomplished. And they've been the background of every good leader we've ever had in this country, including presidents, whatever you want to term. And I question very much the legitimacy of taxing people that have already been taxed not only once but several times. And I don't think there's any edifice of dishonesty going on, carried on by any church institution anywhere in America.
Well, Reverend, you had several points.
They ought to have the private rights anyone else desires and anyone else enjoys, regardless of what other organization is found in America.
Well, Reverend Roman, you raised several interesting questions, so we'll allow Mr. Balk to respond to you.
Yes, I'll try to cover them quickly, and thank you for raising them. As to the matter of whether the church people should be taxed again, the question that non-churchgoers raise is, should they be taxed extra to support things they do not believe in? That is the other side of the coin there. As I say, we must remember, however, that there is no great sentiment in this country now and for the foreseeable future for taxing churches on the church edifice. You raised a number of other points. I think I would sum up by saying the whole spirit of the questioning that's going on in the churches and outside about these issues is, sure, the church has made contributions in the past. It has a great tradition. It's very vital to many people and to our society. But can it be better? And if it continues in this direction, isn't it going to be in more trouble? And therefore, these people would concede who hold this viewpoint.
Well, I think
the church has made contributions. They just want to make it better, and they raise these questions for that reason about wealth and how it's used.
Well, Mr. Bork, when the question is raised about double taxation that as Reverend Raymer is posing now,
yes.
We have federal taxes, we have state taxes, and we have other taxes that we pay.
Yes.
Now, aren't we being doubly taxed already in a sense?
Well, I'm not sure I understand what he means by doubly taxed in that you or I or Reverend Raymer only are taxed one income tax return by the federal government, tax return for state, and so on. We have different levels of government. That's our federal system. They fulfill different functions. Where you get into questions is when you're excused from paying taxes as an organization or an individual. Well, the others then have to move up, you see.
May I speak to this once again?
Yes.
I believe when an honest man has paid his taxes, regardless if he's religious or irreligious.
Yes.
When an honest man has paid his taxes and done his just effort, and the government itself is satisfied with that effort, I do not see where a second reason would be a justifiable matter to re-tax such a person or to accuse him of claiming a right to spend his money where he desires to spend it for himself or the good of others.
Well, I'm not sure I understand your point, because churches are not taxed, and therefore a church member does not have to pay twice.
I want to make it very, very clear. The church people are taxed.
Yes, churches are not taxed.
They're amongst the heaviest because they pay their government tax, and then they are taxed by the church itself.
No, the church does not levy a tax.
The church does levy a tax. The church has apportionments. It has 1,001 other things which churches participate in.
That's a contribution.
Well, this is not a contribution. We oftentimes term it taxation.
Well, and the churches do not have the power to levy taxes. Taxes are compulsory. In Germany, they do, and prostitutes and others pay for support of churches, and some churchmen are uncomfortable. But in this country, we do not levy taxes for support of churches. We believe in separation of church and state and think they're both better off that way.
Well, of course, the state doesn't, but the church does.
Mr. Raymond?
We do. I know that our people, they pay the benevolent fees. They pay many other fees to the continuation of a society buildup, regardless what it is.
Reverend Raymond, thank you for calling, sir.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Bork, we have just about 10 seconds, and we wanted to get into the area of what could be done. I don't know if you can tell us all of this in 10 seconds, but perhaps we'll get one or two suggestions.
Well, very quickly, I think most authorities talking about change feel the churches should get above boards and make public reports, first of all, so we know where everything stands. That perhaps the business exemption loophole should be closed.
Mr. Bork, thank you so much for being our guest tonight on Night Call.
Thank you.
This is Del Shields in New York. Good night and peace.
Night Call, the first and only nationwide listener call-in show on vital issues. Monday night, same time, same station, Richard Garvin, author of Where They Go to Die on the Problems of Growing Old. Listen Monday night. Discuss freely and responsibly your own personal opinions. Speak for yourself on Night Call. Produced by the United Methodist Church, presented with National Council of Churches, National Catholic Office for Radio and Television, American Jewish Committee, and Urban Coalition.